One, hold the paper up. One, two, three.
You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Steeder.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Monday, December 9th, 2013. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, Huffington Post Zach Carter on the recently leaked TPP, Trans-Pacific Partnership documents. We said last week that there's a deal afoot to give this and other trade agreements fast-track authority to the Obama administration, and the blowback on these TPP documents continue to resound. This is probably the most important policy, I guess, development that is ongoing that is also least reported. And I think that just shows why they do this in secret. Also on the program today, Detroit losing its public pensions, perhaps, or at least cutting them. Meanwhile, in Illinois, while Detroit's happened with bankruptcy, Illinois, by the hand of the democratically controlled legislature and governor, cutting Illinois public worker pensions. This is just the beginning, folks. Rand Paul, proving that he is both heartless and also brainless in the same clip, folks. You will enjoy that. And an interesting story about, we've said time and time again that the problem with the U.S. healthcare system is a function of why of the cost of medicine and medical care. A great piece on why Aviston costs 40 times less than Lucentis, but they do the exact same thing and are from the same company. We will talk more about the minimum wage, as Smokey Joe Barton says, if it was up to him, he'd get rid of it totally. New reports out about the lack of mobility in this country in terms of economic class. And a big story on poverty in the New York Times. All that and more. Just quickly, story last week about the demise of progressive talk radio. This is, of course, has been a slow motion demise for years. The biggest blow, of course, was when I was fired from my 9 to noon slot. Now, 5 or 6 years ago. From Air America, but one of the stations that the Majority Report was on back in the day in California was KTLK. We had great ratings, but for the fact that we were preempted quite often, I think for Clippers games on KTLK, and apparently the death of KATLK has not even, it wasn't even the Lakers. It was the Clippers, I think. KTLK as a progressive radio station is no more. Apparently, I guess they, I'm not in LA, I don't listen to it, but they had, I think Randy Rhodes was on that station, Stephanie Miller, I'm not sure who they had in the 12 to 3 slot out there, but it is no longer a liberal talk radio station. They're moving Rush Limbaugh over from KFI. Folks, look, the future of liberal talk is not on terrestrial radio. There will be some, hopefully, forever, but the future is going to be programs like this one that stream live on the internet, that get delivered by a podcast. Ultimately, we will be listening to streaming internet on in our cars far more than we will terrestrial radio. If you're looking for a show that has any type of national relevance. And so for us to get there, we need to improve our infrastructure. We need to improve our resources in the office, as it were. And so your membership will help us get there. So become a member today at majority.fm. It's going to be interesting to see what happens to right-wing talk radio when Limbaugh's gone, because he, of course, anchors most of this stuff. And but we'll see. Who knows how long that guy can last? I mean, God knows what kind of drugs they prop him up with. All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to oh, and I should say KTLK also was the home of Ring of Fire Radio. I don't know if we're going to stay on the weekends. But my guess is if they're changing the format, we're probably gone from there, too. But fortunately, in L.A., Ring of Fire is on a couple of stations out there. But it's a big loss. It's a big loss. There's no doubt about it. All right, we're going to take a break. We'll be right back with Zach Carter. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program senior political economy reporter for Huffington Post and a host and producer of HuffPost Live, Zach Carter. Welcome to the program, Zach.
Thanks for having me, Sam.
All right, Zach, now you've got a piece from, I guess it was yesterday, Sunday, in the Huffington Post, on the backlash now that President Obama and the administration, and frankly, this is also being mirrored around the world, and the backlash upon the revelations of at least part of what is involved in the TPP. Tell us what the TPP is.
Okay, so the TPP is an acronym for the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and it's probably the most significant large-scale trade agreement that the United States has at least attempted to enter into since NAFTA in 1993. Its critics refer to it as NAFTA on steroids, and you know the defenders of the deal often say, you know, this is a great way to eliminate tariffs and create jobs, but a lot of the same criticisms that have been around about free trade agreements, or so-called free trade agreements, have been launched against this one because it seems to be a particularly aggressive version of a lot of the things that have been problematic in the past. The agreement appears to give corporations the right to challenge laws and regulations in international courts and potentially seek some sort of redress for the rules of a democratically elected government. It's got implications for everything from internet freedom to the environment. The deal's been conducted, or the negotiations for the deal have been conducted largely in secret. So we don't know very much about the specific provisions of the deal, but what we do know has come through leaks, and we got a couple yesterday.
Okay, now before we get to that, to the leaks that you guys got, and, but now I want to stop you on one point that you made. My understanding is that the difference between the TPP in terms of resolving of attacking regulations that any individual sovereign country has deemed appropriate for their country, whether they are consumer regulations, whether they are worker labor regulations, environmental regulations. One of the primary differences in the architecture of the TPP, and we should say that we only know what has been leaked so far, and those are sort of disparate chapters. But the difference in this architecture is that unlike the WTO, where if an industry in a particular country feels that the regulations that have been imposed in another country breach the rules of the WTO, this international court, as you say, is not an international court. This is a tribunal that is set up specifically with corporate lawyers. My understanding is a 3-member board on each specific sort of realm. So, in fact, the WTA goes to a body that is comprised is slightly different than from the TPP.
Yes. I mean, under WTO, the WTO framework, if you're a corporation in one country trying to do business in another, and you have a problem in this other country, you've got to make it a political issue. You have to take it to the country, your home country, and have them have your government essentially bring up the case at the WTO. You can't just say, I, corporation, am angry about this new regulation, and therefore I will sue this sovereign government. Under the framework of TPP, a corporation can just circumvent the sort of government middleman there and sue the foreign government directly. This applies to foreign corporations operating in the United States and, of course, to domestic corporations operating abroad. That basic framework has been around since NAFTA, though. I mean, that idea is not totally revolutionary. What's particularly new about or what appears to be new based on the documentation we got yesterday is that the scope of what corporations could challenge in these courts is significantly broader than what was what we've seen under NAFTA and subsequent agreements. And one of the ways that's backed up is because Mexico and Canada, the countries that are in NAFTA, are also part of the TPP agreement. And according to the documents we got yesterday, they're resisting this deal for the very reasons we just outlined, that it appears to offer a very broad variety of corporate challenges to democratic rule.
All right. So now talk about the documents that you received and just compare and contrast those to the ones that WikiLeaks seems to have leaked over time.
Yesterday WikiLeaks published basically the exact same documents we did a couple hours late after we did. And these are internal memos from the ministry of one of the countries involved in the TPP negotiations. It's pretty safe to say it's not the United States, but we're not able to confirm which country it was. We were able to confirm that it was from a ministry involved in the talks. And what you see in these documents is a great deal of resistance on some of the key provisions of the deal. They're obviously very complex and technical provisions, but one of the main ones is just the scope of the agreement, what types of things can be challenged in international court. There also appears to be a lot of resistance to some of the intellectual property standards, which sound like really nerdy, complicated things, and they are. but they have to do with everything from the price of medicines to internet freedom. If you have particularly aggressive intellectual property standards, it becomes very difficult to innovate in a lot of spheres, and of course it can raise the prices of stuff because it, you know, patents and other types of IP grant these monopolies to innovators. So there's all sorts of stuff in there that countries seem to be uncomfortable with. We should emphasize, though, that the document was heavily redacted. There could be stuff in there that puts things in a different context. We don't know, but to the best of our knowledge, this seemed like a fair reading to say that there was significant resistance to some of the more important aspects of the agreement.
And also, let's talk about financial regulation. To what extent are the complaints in these memos outlined about financial regulation? And how does what Jack Lew said recently, I guess it was at the Pew Charitable Trust, implied that the TPP and sort of the cousin, I guess, agreement that's also being negotiated in secret, one with the EU, will not essentially create a race to the bottom when it comes to, or the lowest common denominator when it comes to financial regulations?
Well, it's hard to say whether anything that that Jack Lew said about, say, the Volcker Rule or the implementation of Obama's 2010 Wall Street Reform Bill, how that would be affected by this agreement. I think, in general, the financial regulatory terms of this deal are, like everything else, have been kept secret. But what we learned yesterday is that there seems to be some significant resistance to those terms. In particular, because of restrictions that the U.S. wants to put, and the Obama administration wants to place on capital controls. The specific language here is very important. Capital controls can be anything from, lending restrictions in overheated markets. If housing is really going up, saying, banks, you should have to, hold more capital against new housing loans. So it's sort of a way to discourage banks from making home loans. To what you do with currency inflows and outflows from your country during a crisis. The United States, when it's had financial crises in the past, hasn't had a big currency run, in part because we can print our own currency, and in part because I think global investors have still a great deal of confidence in the United States politically, even when there's a financial crisis. In other countries, that's not necessarily the case. We've definitely seen during financial panics in other countries just mass outflows of money from the country, and that can be a huge problem when you're a government trying to stem a financial panic and figure out what to do. So there's a lot of worry, it seems like, according to these documents, about particularly those capital controls and what tools would be available to countries to manage a financial crisis. Free traders have said that this type of regulation, like others, you don't want the country to be unfairly manipulating the currency in order to get some sort of unfair trade advantage. But the specific language on capital controls right now seems to be very problematic for several of the countries involved in the talks.
And I want to get back to the proposal that the U.S. introduced that essentially would prevent other governments from negotiating lower drug prices with pharmaceutical companies. When I see something like that, and I know that there's at least some rhetoric in this country from the Obama administration, or certainly from the Democrats, that we should have the ability to do this in the context of Medicare Part D. Am I wrong? And of course, this is a subject to some of the pushback from other countries, because this is what other countries do to keep down their medicine prices. This essentially is one of those things where 2 years from now, we can turn around and say, well, we can't do this because we signed the TPP.
Well, that's the big worry for a lot of the sort of public interest do-gooder groups involved in these talks that are monitoring these talks. The worry is not so much that there's something that's going to be passed right now that's in direct conflict with U.S. law, although there are people who do worry about those things. The bigger worry is that, okay, there will be some new standard that's set based on today's status quo, and maybe that status quo is not awesome, and we want to fix that in the future. Well, we can't do that, because if we fix it in the future, we'll be imposing new laws and regulations that conflict with this agreement, and we can get sued in international court or before one of these international tribunals. And that's that does happen. I mean, we saw in particular, mm-hmm. when when Congress was talking about updating patent laws a couple years ago, we had a very, very weak patent reform bill. It didn't really do very much. And one of the reasons, I mean, explicitly lawmakers said, you know, we're worried that this, the sort of steps that people want to take to really fix the patent system would conflict with international law, and our hands are just tied. You know, these things really do happen, and they do have consequences, both in the United States, but especially abroad. People really worry that, you know, the United States is capable of exercising an extraordinary amount of political pressure at the negotiation phase. But once you have an actual text there, you never know what the United States government is going to insist is actually implied by that text. And so a lot of countries involved are worried. You know, these new standards, which for them would be new, you know, imposing lengthy patent terms on medications, all kinds of new intellectual property standards that would grant drug companies long-term monopolies. These type of standards, any other flexibilities that might be, you know, available to the countries would suddenly be cut off by the United States, and that would be, they'd face a lot of resistance to stuff that's just about keeping, you know, their public healthy, and the United States appears to have been very aggressive on this front.
And it boomerangs back to us. I mean, essentially what we would need, we're setting up a system where to the extent that we want to change regulations or procedures that allow us to negotiate and drive down the prices of pharmaceuticals, we would end up perhaps basically having to pay these corporations for the right to do that at this point, right? I mean, because that's effectively what happens. They, we've seen cases like this with Canada, and I think coming across the border the other direction, where there are regulations that are instituted that prevent corporations from realizing their projected profits by engaging in some practice in this other country, and essentially the country is fined billions upon billions of dollars to make up for the loss of this corporation's projected profits.
Right. That's basically the worry. You know, if you talk to people from the administration, they say, look, we're not trying to impose any standards in the TPP that are gonna actually be restrictions on food safety or public health or financial regulation or any of these things. But then they keep the actual terms of the agreement secret. And when stuff leaks, like the intellectual property chapter that WikiLeaks leaked a couple of weeks ago, the standards in there look very frightening to a lot of, you know, serious global public health people who worry that it's going to inflate the cost of medicines. And there's no reason in principle why these same sort of things couldn't happen back here at home. And in fact, we have seen, you know, on patent law that legislatures are resistant to even undertake reforms because they're worried they might conflict with trade law, and they're worried they might eventually be sued in international court. So you end up getting this sort of new political power that corporations are able to bring in the legislative process, both at home and abroad, where people in government worry that, you know, if we go too far in the name of the public interest, we could get ourselves in trouble, and so then important reforms just sort of stall out.
And so now, right now, I've seen conflicting things, or I should say, over the past, I'd say, month, in terms of the potential for fast track authority given to the Obama administration. We should say that right now, TPP negotiators are negotiating in secret in Singapore. We know very little of what's in this deal, but for those things that have been leaked, and apparently, but for leaks that have come from trade, and by trade, I mean actual industry representatives who have passed this information on to their individual congresspeople. Give me your sense of what the state of play is in terms of fast track.
Well, you know, WikiLeaks has also released some documents on the actual content of the bill, but it's hard to say on fast track because fast track, of course, is this process under which a trade bill is considered, and Congress can't make any real changes to the
no amendments, no filibusters in the Senate.
Exactly. This thing is negotiated by the administration. We're just you know, putting the congressional seal of approval on it. That's for many members of Congress that they feel like that is not the not consistent with their sort of obligations under the Constitution. They should be exercising more oversight. The administration, of course, always says, well, look, if we had 535 members of Congress effectively negotiating this deal in public, nothing would ever get done, which I think is a fair point. But we do have a democratic process, and there are people, both the Republican Party and the Democratic Party, who are worried about fast track. The latest I've heard is that Dave Camp, the House Ways and Means Committee Chairman, and Max Baucus, the Senate Finance Committee Chairman, both are still in favor of introducing a fast-track bill very soon. Whether that will actually go anywhere is another question. It seems like other support from traditional allies of the fast-track process is not as strong right now as it was, say, a couple years ago when the administration was able to pass the Colombia Free Trade Agreement and the Panama Free Trade Agreement and the South Korea Free Trade Agreement. So I think we'll see that there are clearly hundreds of members of the House who are on the record opposing this fast-track process. Whether that resistance actually holds up once a bill comes to the floor is always something can always be a bit of an adventure to watch. But resistance to these deals has been growing over time. There were a very significant number of Democrats that opposed Obama's three free trade deals the last time around. And in particular, the involvement of the tech community this time around seems to have ratcheted up some of the resistance from otherwise people who otherwise support the general goals of these free trade agreements are worried about new issues like internet freedom being brought into the game.
And there's issues also with cell phone unlocking is also a big one that I think came out I don't know a couple of weeks ago as well, right?
Right. The administration had said that it favors cell phone unlocking domestically, but then when you looked at some of the information that had been leaked from the draft text of negotiation, it appeared that cell phone unlocking would have been banned. And so while currently it is the sort of provision that people worried, this is going to tie the administration's hands from doing what they want to do domestically. And, I haven't heard any updates in several months on that issue, but the last I had heard, it seemed like USTR was trying to correct that. So that was USTR is the Office of the U.S. Trade Representative. It's the wing of the White House that negotiates the stuff. They were trying to fix that, but it underscored the basic dilemma with these types of agreements. If you're doing an international trade deal, to make it work at all, you have to have some sort of independent body that's able to check and enforce the deal. But if you're writing very broad statutes or very broad rules and standards, there's a lot of stuff that you might want to do in the future that you can cut yourself off from.
Right, and I'm just sort of really struck by the, you touched on this a little bit in that there's a sort of a new component to the resistance of this deal beyond sort of the traditional environmental labor groups, people who are concerned about things like internet freedoms and copyright uses. And it's also so surprising to me, frankly, that because of the scope of what things is covered here and the nature of the fact that you don't even need the sponsorship of a sovereign nation to go to this tribunal, that it's really just about, companies going and dealing with companies, that there isn't more from the far right in terms of, when we talk about the one world government, in some respects, this deal, it seems to me, really does inhibit the ability of sovereign nations to come up with their own set of environmental, labor, consumer, internet protections, et cetera, that this is sort of what people were, afraid of, right? This one world government.
Yeah, I'm not totally I'm not an expert on the 30 years of right wing thought on this subject, but you have seen some very conservative members of Congress oppose this on essentially those grounds, on national sovereignty grounds. There was a letter that went around a couple of weeks ago which had some of the hardest line Tea Partiers, people like Paul Brown from Georgia, Michelle Bachmann, saying we don't like this deal. This is not good for American sovereignty, even though these people in general support the actual provisions of the deal. I think for the most part, a lot of the stuff there on on reducing the regulatory burdens or restricting the future regulatory burdens for corporations is stuff that would be very much in the ideological wheelhouse of these members. They were still opposing it on sovereignty grounds, and there is a bit of history there. Ron Paul has opposed these types of deals in the past. A lot of libertarians are very active in opposing this type of agreement for that very reason, even though they tend to actually agree on matters of actual concrete policy. But it goes to show, you know, NPR actually, Planet Money did a really nice spot last week on tariffs in the Colombia Free Trade Agreement. It was a great explanation about how tax policy effectively works and, you know, can give birth to whole new industries in certain countries and destroy them. But that is not really what most people argue about when they argue about trade agreements anymore. There does seem to be, I think, a general consensus that, you know, tariffs, when they're empirically clearly a bad idea, should be removed. But most of what people fight about when they fight about trade policy is regulatory policy and,
right.
and the authority to write regulatory policy.
Right. We've moved from tariffs into sort of defining down what tariffs are, just in terms of sort of issues about what kind of society we want to structure, and it's considered sort of a de facto tariff. This is an extreme example. It's a de facto tariff if we don't want candy imported here to have arsenic in it. Right? I mean, because we're making it much harder to reach our consumers who are desperate for that low-cost candy. I guess.
Right. And, you know, I don't think there's going to be anything in the TPP that would make it difficult to bring a case against, you know, arsenic candy, for instance.
Right.
But that is, in principle, the point is exactly right. That there would be you are turning over a lot of the authority to write these rules and to write future rules when facts on the ground change. I mean, one of the reasons why tech activists and internet freedom activists are getting involved now is just because this is an area where historically, you know, copyright laws, longer terms, more stricter types of copyright language have actually been good for American businesses. You know, that means you have more protection for very old copyrights and Mickey Mouse movies and things like that you know, are 70 years old. They're still protected by copyright. That's not necessarily true. I mean, the world has changed with the internet, and a lot of those strict provisions mean that some of the things that you could do that are really innovative on the internet, just using old material and repurposing it, become becomes a shady area. You know, are you violating copyright when you tweet a link to something that is illegally posted in violation of copyright? You know, most Twitter users don't think they're breaking the law when they do that, and certainly Twitter doesn't want to be held responsible for doing that. But figuring out the right policy there is a pretty complicated, intricate technical task. There isn't an easy, immediate answer that, you know, longer copyright terms are better or shorter copyright terms are better. There's got to be some sort of tailored solution. And if you have a very broad set of standards included in a trade deal, you might be reluctant to make, you know, to find the appropriate balance in your domestic policy.
Yeah, I mean, I frankly would be very curious to hear the arguments as to why necessarily it is better that we extend these Disney patents. I mean, these trademarks. I mean, the argument for these things is that we want to be able to protect the rights that an inventor has for these to promote invention. But these inventors, these creators are long gone. They were all work for hires at that point anyway. They're owned by a corporation that's providing to the shareholders. I don't, you know, the logic of that stuff. But like you say, the point here is that we then lose the ability to have this debate. Because it's no longer in the context of the society in which we live. It is a function of this one board made up of lawyers with vested interests in all these industries. So, I mean, give me a sense in terms of the timeline here. Is there a window where this thing is actually dead? I mean, this thing's been negotiated for a long time. They're trying to get this done. They need the fast track authority because I think there is at least an awareness that the longer this stuff is shown in the light of day, the tougher time it has to pass, which in and of itself is a fairly damning, I think, is a damning critique of it. But I mean, what's the window here? Is there a point where it's like if they don't get fast track in the next 3 months, then you're too close to an election? Or is, you know, when it comes to passing a process that sort of leaves lawmakers without any type of recourse when it comes to sort of giving a big corporate giveaways, then that's evergreen. You can do it at any time.
You know, it's very difficult to say at this moment. The administration has said that it wants to get these deals done by the end of the year, but it also said that last year and the year before, and of course the deals didn't get done, and yet they're still being negotiated. No one's declared them dead. They've even brought in several new countries to the talks over that time period. So I think it's hard for me to imagine the administration ever just declaring this thing formally dead. But I do think there is a lot of pressure on Congress right now to make a move, and the administration. I think the Singapore talks, the administration feels like if they don't sort of put up or shut up and get something that is a deal or looks very much like a deal this week, that the prospects for something going forward just get smaller and smaller over time. But Congress is very, very good at doing things that corporate interests like. They have a long history of finding ways to do this, even amid particularly rancorous eras of bipartisan gridlock like we've seen over the last couple of years. The farm bill subsidies still find a way to pass the House every year. They may be more contentious than they have been in the past, but they still find a way to subsidize those corporations. And so when you've got just about every major corporation in the United States saying, I want this bill, and a not completely implausible argument that these bills could in some way be positive for jobs. I'm not saying that. I think that empirical case is actually very complicated and not easy to make convincingly, but it's not crazy, right? You could say, okay, good, if we improved our trade policy, we would sell more stuff and there would be more jobs, and that would be better. You can see politicians making that kind of argument to their constituents, and complex discussions about intellectual property and international sovereignty sort of are not necessarily the easiest arguments to make in public, and not necessarily arguments that the public responds to particularly aggressively. So I don't think it's dead by any stretch, and I think there's a very, very real chance that, especially if you find a way to appease the Silicon Valley companies and the tech companies on internet freedom issues, that you'll lose a lot of the corporate resistance to the deal and see something going through relatively quickly once that breaks down.
Mm. All right, Zach Carter, senior political economy reporter from Huffington Post. Thanks so much for your time today.
Great talking to you, Sam.
All right, folks. Before we head into, I want to talk about this story about the Avestan and the Lucentis. It's a fascinating story that was in the Washington Post, and it is just one of many stories that give you an indication of just why it is that this country pays double what any other Western industrialized country pays to provide health care on a per capita basis to its citizens. And I'm not just talking about what is spent on the in the private sector, but also even the public sector. So we spend even more per capita, more than any other Western industrialized country, and we don't, as a government, and we don't cover, we don't ensure access to health insurance still for all of our citizens in this country. But this is a perfect example, and this is also, and I don't know if this is something that is specifically indicative of the dynamic that will be created under the TPP and its cousin, I don't know what they call the EU partnership or something opaque like that. But there are two drugs out there that are used in the treatment of a degenerative eye disease, wet age-related macular degeneration. And this is apparently, as you get older, your macular degenerates, and you can go blind.
How's your macula doing, Sam?
I have no idea, but I imagine not well. The official treatment for this is a drug called Lucentis. It costs $2,000 per injection. It has been developed by a company called Genentech, which is a division of the Roche Group. Prior to releasing Lucentis at $2,000 per injection, Genentech years earlier had released a drug called Avastin, which was used in the treatment of different types of cancers, colon cancer, other types of cancers. At one point, a doctor, when they were trying to figure out how to treat, this is prior to Lucentis being developed, when they were trying to treat, figure out how to treat the this degenerative eye disease, a doctor started to experiment with Avastin, using it in basically an off-label use, is what they call. They were testing it in the same dosage, and they stumbled across the fact that it was helping this eye disease. However, the drug, Avastin, given in that amount, has a lot of difficult side effects. So they cut the dosage and directly injected it essentially close to the eye or in the eye. And they found that it was incredibly effective for this this ailment. And they did so before Genentech, which apparently had also realized this, had come out with Lucentis, which is essentially, according to a Toledo ophthalmologist who founded a group called Physicians for Clinical Responsibility, they found that Lucentis is Avastin. It's the same, this is a quote, it's the same damn molecule with few cosmetic changes, i.e. dosage size. And so what was happening before the development of Lucentis, and continues to happen, was that secondary drug companies were buying Avastin, cutting the size of the dosage, reselling it to doctors in a lower dosage, one that you can actually give easier to the patients in terms of an injection, so that there's no questioning how much you've actually pulled out of whatever the injection is. And it's being treated. So about 50% of the doctors out there use Avastin as repackaged by other companies. And 50% use Lucentis. The question is, obviously, why would you use Lucentis? And that is because doctors, when they are administering a drug and are being reimbursed by Medicare, get a 6% markup from the cost of the drug. Even I can do this math. 6% of $50 is around, I don't know, $2.75. 6% of 2,000 is closer to, I don't know, what, $170? On top of that, Genentech offers rebates to doctors who use large volumes of the more expensive drug. In other words, kickbacks. Because they're not going to pass that kickback on to their patients.
They should be able to profit too. After all, we are not communists.
That's right. And unfortunately, the FDA does not have the ability to compel Genentech to get Avastin approved for the use in the treatment of this drug. Now, because it's off-label and because it's found to have, it's already been tested in terms of safety, and because we actually have a drug regime in this country where you don't have to prove that a drug is actually effective or more effective than another drug to sell it in that way. In this instance, it is helping people because the drug company refuses to apply for a license for the cheaper drug. So this just goes to show you just how bizarre our system is in this country. Now, if we had Medicare had the ability to say, hey, you know, we're not going to provide reimbursement for Lucentis because there's no point in that. You can get a drug that is 40 times cheaper. It is proven to be just as effective. There have been 6 clinical trials now that have shown that it actually is as effective and is no less safe. In fact, the only safety issues that come up that are infinitesimally small but exist are in the processing of Avastin into smaller doses and being resold. There was a scare about this in some other drug. I can't remember what it was a couple of months ago, because you have some of these repackaging companies where there's potential for contamination. So we have no authority in terms of like Medicare to say, we're not going to reimburse you for this clearly more expensive, less effective, or I should say equally effective drug. And so doctors continue to charge Medicare for this. You're talking billions upon billions of dollars simply wasted because a company has figured out, like, we can put up our sort of more expensive label designer version of this drug, which does the exact same thing. And Medicare, one of the biggest buyers of this, payers for this drug, essentially, they're not buying it. The doctors are buying it. Buyers of this drug, or I should say payers of this drug, they can't do anything about it. Because Sarah Palin will be out there screaming death panels. You're not allowing these people to inject themselves with the exact same drug and a 40 times more cost point. It's communism. And as far as I can tell, that there's a provision in that TPP that would prevent countries from sort of making those types of determinations. I don't know if it would apply in this necessary set, but that's the dynamic. So this is another installment of this is why our medicine and medical treatment in this country costs so much more than in any other industrialized nation. It's because we allow this, I don't know, I would call it fraud, but snake oil, essentially, to be legalized. Or the snake oil packaging, maybe. It's a fascinating story. We'll link to it on the blog. It's in the Washington Post. All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, 2 clips from one interview that show that not only is Rand Paul sort of an a-hole, but also an idiot. And or the people who listen to him are both as well.
Also, maybe the stupidest question ever asked at a White House briefing.
Yeah, I don't know.
It's possible.
Certainly, it's got to be up there in the running. Pantheon. But very impressive. CNN right now, they must be. It must be. I'm convinced that most of their programming and most of their reporting is really just like sort of some type of inter-office betting pool. Like, what's the weirdest thing that we could put on TV and call it news? What's the stupidest question we could ask?
Dude, check out what I'm going to ask at the briefing today.
Yes.
Check it out.
Who can get more YouTube hits off of their stupid question? Interesting story of the Pope sneaking out of the Vatican at night to, if you can believe this, helping homeless people. Disgusting.
KGB.
KGB. Rule number one, we'll also get into those Illinois public pensions in what we call the funner half of the program. Number 646-257-3920. I am remembering now to turn on my IM machine. Maybe later we'll do a push notification. You know, when we don't do that, we should put out a push notification for the release of the podcast. That's something we could do, too.
That is definitely something you can do with your sole control over the push notifications.
That's right.
Indeed.
He who has the power over the push notifications. You can give us a call, 646-257-3920. You can IM us at the various IMs that we have. You can IM us through the app, which you can get at majorityapp.com. You can give us an iTunes review on iTunes. You can support this program, like I said, by becoming a member. 33 cents a day allows us to continue to bring you the finest in political talk, independent political talk. You can also support this program by buying your Amazon crap. If you buy anything from Amazon, go to majorityreportkickback.com. Click on the Amazon link. It's very easy. It's the only link there, right in the middle of the page. And bookmark it. Buy all your Amazon junk through that link. You will notice no difference. It doesn't do anything different to your buying crap on Amazon experience. But because there's like a little code embedded there, when you buy stuff, even off of that first page, we get a kickback. MajorityReportKickback.com. JustCoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate makes a great Christmas, New Year's, Kwanzaa, late Hanukkah, early Passover, Tu Shvat, gift, coffee, tea, or chocolate. Coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. You can buy the Majority Report blend. Don't forget, we're being sponsored by Credo. Go to credomobile.com/Sam. 25% off of data for 2 years. Up to $350 credit on a buyout. And they've got new non-Android phones. Find the link. We got a banner on our homepage at majority.fm. Check it out. All right, folks. See you in the fun house.